Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for September 29th, 2010. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast. In it, I have a new hacker word of the week, and I also have, as promised, a hacker-oriented review of one of my very favorite films, Brazil. First, though, since I last talked to you, shared that announcement about the changes to the feed and the audio, I actually have an update. I have one change to that plan for the better. I mentioned that chapter marks would be disappearing from the enhanced feed due to an apparent lack of tools under Linux for setting chapter marks on an AAC MP4 encoded audio file. I was very pleased to be proven wrong on this point earlier this week. Listener, friend, and sometime code collaborator Jay posted a comment with a pointer to the MP4 V2 project at Google Code. One of the utilities in that project, MP4 Chaps, can consume a plain text file and set chapter marks on an existing audio file. I've done some minimal testing, and it looks like it should be trivial to enhance my encoding script to include this step. Even better, I can very easily extract the time offsets and text from my note-taking format for the show, streamlining my overall production process just a little bit further. So, come Sunday the 3rd, the only effect of the cutover will be a one-time re-download of old episodes in the feeds. I'm thrilled that my change to using Linux and all open source and free software for producing the show will be virtually unnoticeable from the outside. That may seem like an odd sentiment, but remember that it isn't a priority at all for me to convince anyone else to adopt open source or free software. Don't get me wrong, I think there are plenty of practical advantages in addition to the matters of principles that inform my own choice. I just think it makes more sense to have low-drama conversations about relative merits to provide a good example free of the usual zealotry and ultimately respect everyone else's choice to use whatever they wish. In that vein, taking a hard line on producing only Ogg Vorbis and FLAC encoded audio is incompatible with my views. I think it's far better to keep offering the choice I have always offered, as long as the relevant patent holders make that feasible anyway, and be available to discuss rationally and quietly how unencumbered formats compare to their encumbered counterparts. The hacker word of the week comes from the jargon file maintained by Eric Raymond at catb.org. Fin, verb, irk, to pull rank on somebody based on the amount of time one has spent on irk. The term derives from the fact that irk was originally written in Finland in 1987. There may be some influence from the Fin character in William Gibson's seminal cyberpunk novel Count Zero, who at one point says to another, much younger character, I have a pair of shoes older than you are, so shut up. Brazil is one of my absolute favorite movies. The dystopian society Gilliam portrays is clearly one where technology plays a key role. It occurred to me to re-watch the film, with an eye towards the different characters. I hadn't thought about it, but were any of the characters hacker heroes? What other themes resonate beyond the set dressing of the retro-futuristic mainframes and terminals? I will admit that the story is rambling, hard to make sense of. It's a demanding film. For me, that's part of its charm. It draws your attention in order to puzzle it out, like many entertainments hackers enjoy. That may mean this film is not for you, though you may want to just give it a couple of tries to let the story unfold a bit more and see if it draws you in. Brazil is part of Gilliam's so-called Dreams Trilogy, a label his fans and critics have applied to it, along with the films Time Bandits and Baron Munchausen. I love all three films and appreciate the common thread. In all of them, Gilliam explores the power of dream at different stages. The midlife fantasy aspect of Brazil in particular appeals to me more as I get older. Even though I don't work in a bureaucracy, parts of it resonates with my Nowhere to Go rant. Especially during my re-watching to research for this segment, that aspect of the film was especially poignant to me. Central Services is a pretty obvious place to start. It factors into the very first scene of the movie. We are treated to an advertisement that rambles on about all kinds of ducks. I recall that Gilliam was appalled at how old buildings in England were retrofitted with external pipes and ducts. The desire for modern conveniences ended up obscuring the beautiful original architecture of many buildings. In hacker terms, the ducts are a symbol of cruft. That is, anything accumulated in source code that doesn't fit cleanly into the program. Like Brazil's central services, aberrations creep into code to serve some convenient end with little or no regard for the overall elegance of the combined result. Few people in the world of Brazil seem to really know or care about the function of the ducts. I've seen this same ignorance even among hackers, though usually of the younger ones who aren't as familiar with the risk of cruft. Even our hero, Sam, is at the mercy of central services at first. Centrally managed facilities are a villain. They are a manifestation of the larger system Sam ultimately has to fight. Even in the opening, where his centrally managed flat fails to wake him up in the very first scenes we see him, we get a foreshadowing of how his ignorance of the hidden and not-so-hidden works is a problem he'll eventually have to face. Sam's very inability to hack central services directly forms part of his motivation. His reliance on Tuttle to manage the trouble in his flat, that this impotence arising from it may in part spur him, through frustration, to attack a system he can hack, to apply the skills he does have to the Ministry of Information Systems. To push the image further, the ducts even appear as living things, literally breathing when the panels in the flat are open, revealing it the very guts of the world around him. The role of technology is deeply ambivalent. That is, there is a very thorough and weird mix of old and new. We see crude but stylish computers, clearly utterly dependent on some central big system. It is a visible reminder of the centralized and brooding presence of central services. The robot in the lobby of the Ministry of Information is meant to be cutting edge, but it is easily upset and revealed to be ineffectual. There is an echo on Sam's fantasy life. The means of Dream Sam's flight are mechanical wings. It's not unaided direct flight, but reliable, simple, but elegant tools. We even see a subversive stab at retrofuturism. There is a dystopic take on food in pill form, or the extrapolation of an automat, a fad roughly contemporary with the noir style of the film. There is a rigid insistence on ordering by the system, by number. The inflexibility of the centralized state reflects even into the experience of dining. When the food is delivered, it's unpalatable, unrecognizable. You could imagine it being extruded from some appendage of central services. The broken aspects of this world are inescapable, even in the places where the characters might seek escape. And it's hard to determine. It's somewhat vague as to whether that brokenness is a function of the actors in the system or, like that cruft I mentioned at the outset, something that just accrued sort of organically as a character, an essential character of this world in which the story is embedded. The technology allows the dysfunction to pervade all aspects. This is a powerful juxtaposition to the ultimate escape of Sam's dreams. Despite the overwhelming rules and central control, technology still remains hackable. We see evidence of it being subverted to what its users really want. That is most evident in the Department of Records, where we catch the employees using their terminals to watch TV. This is deeply hackish, slacking by subverting legitimate resources. Sam, as the epitome of that, shows a canny ability to manipulate the system beyond what we initially expect of him. The terrorists to whom we're introduced early on are just a reflection of the system. They are as ineffective in their own way. We see them act destructively, but they aren't able to change anything. The system is resistant through its sheer size and complexity. The attacks may even be perpetuated by the Ministry of Information itself. Like Clay Shirky says, systems designed to solve a problem often evolve to ensure they still have a reason for being. Think about it. The terrorists are faceless throughout the film. We suspect that Jill may be working with them, but ultimately any attempt to unmask them, directly or otherwise, fails. There is a hint that the terrorists may come from the unseen underclass. When Sam suspects Jill is making a delivery on behalf of the terrorists, it's the first time we see the industrial setting that must underlie most of the clean, automated world to which Sam is accustomed. This reinforces the notion that the attacks and unrest are as much part of the system as the Ministry of Information and Central Services. The power of fantasy in this film provides not only escape, but hints at something more about our protagonist, Sam. Information and technology are ubiquitous, even invading what might have been a cheery holiday scene in the opening. Sam increasingly has to struggle with his very living quarters, an extension of several central services, and the out-of-kilter system. Beyond providing a pretty obvious way of ignoring the world as it is, Sam's dreams hint at a latent creativity. If Sam weren't a hacker on some level, he would be content to entirely slip into his fantasies. As it is, there is a burr under his saddle, some latent urge to do more, to use the creativity we see in his dream sequences for that end. He barely gets to express it in his day job. I suspect it is what makes him effective when Kurtzman, his boss, is ineffectual. To be fair, Kurtzman could be seen as hacking Sam, working to keep him within the Department of Records. Whatever ingenuity Kurtzman shows in manipulating Sam, though, is an echo of the system as a whole as it works and adjusts to maintain the reason for its own existence. On a side note, Kurtzman's actions are part of a lesser hacker theme, social engineering. We see only a little of Sam hacking actual computers, but do see him being targeted by social exploits and using them himself in turn, even doing the most unsavory, helping Helpman in the loo, in order to smooth his way into info retrieval later in the film. As Kurtzman preys on Sam's clear unease at the Tuttle-Buttle screw-up, much like taking the check to Tuttle's widow, Sam in turn preys on Helpman and his father's standing, this time for his own end, to get to Jill. Kurtzman is the one who pushes Sam unknowingly along, though. His inability to handle the mistake in overcharging Buttle prompts Sam to step into the gap, making up a solution. Watch him when Sam signs the forms to Buttle's refund. He clearly is playing up his injured hand, maybe even making it up. From that point on, though, Sam starts to realize more of his hidden abilities. In the course of following from this initial event, he encounters his dream girl for real, cementing the crossover of his fantasy world with his reality. Sam's dreams are also the kind of modeling and reduction a hacker would do of a system. Each sequence reflects the section of the story, netting it down the forces within it, acting on Sam and the choices presented to him. We see this modeling reflecting back into reality as Sam makes increasingly bolder choices while chasing down Jill. It's easy to see Tuttle, played by Robert De Niro, as a more obvious hacker hero. He is so frustrated with the binding rules and procedures, he strikes out on his own, working outside the system. We learn how frighteningly competent he is, not just as a heating engineer, but working a wrench, a gun, and a zip line with equal ease. Is he a projection of Sam's fantasy, though? One of my personal theories is that Tuttle isn't real. The guilt of dealing with Buttle's widow may cause a small break in Sam that widens as the story progresses. From that, the wish-fulfilling Tuttle may have emerged whole cloth. The scene where Tuttle disappears in a storm of paper is the strongest evidence I can cite, though that may not have been Gilliam's intent with that particular vignette. Think for a moment just how exaggerated Tuttle's character is. See how easily he deals with the things that nettle Sam. I think a case can also be made for Jack as a sort of hacker, anti-hero, or villain, a reflection of a Sam if he were a hacker working within the system, so maybe an antithesis to Tuttle's character. He is a more realistic model on which Sam hangs the realization of his fantasy. Their first encounter in the security stalls shows Sam very much in love with his job and records. But Jack is the seed of an idea to use a promotion to Sam's own ends. We can even see, in some moments, Sam modeling himself on Jack as a more bold, enterprising man. That relationship, that maybe latent envy of his longtime friend and a ladder climber, Jack, at information retrieval, may factor into expectations of Sam, a hacker at defying convention. He shows unease out of routine confronting Buttle's widow, Jack is so ready to conform that he goes to the ridiculous. He effectively renames his wife in the party scene rather than to correct his boss. On confrontation, he tries to deflect blame. There he uses the system, hides behind its rigid parameters. Compared to Tuttle, though, Sam could see himself in Jack's position. It's more approachable, even though it's sinister at the same time. It's a smaller step than becoming the sort of outside-the-system true renegade that Tuttle's character represents. Sam's fear of breaking the law, of stepping outside his comfort, stops him from realizing either, even the closer role that Jack represents. He tries to synthesize the two when he does decide to act to pursue his dream girl. His mention of the 27B/6 is a seed, like Jack's discussion of info retrieval as an ideal and ambitious next step. Much more than the sort of mild hacking he undertook in records, it shows him how he can really impact the system around him, encouraging him to pursue that line more fully as the story progresses. Tuttle reinforces that with his praise, and reinforces Sam's later actions being bound up in the story of Jill and Sam's fieldwork. The Ministry of Information, with all its departments, is also a kind of hackish character. Everyone is ignoring the Ministry, but that's a consequence of its ubiquity. There is the office worker responsible for dropping the wrench in the works that kicks everything off, and Buttle's family with the TV playing the interview with Helpman prattling on. Even Helpman himself is profoundly disconnected. His view is information as a commodity in itself, without any understanding of analysis or real application. The only answers he gives to criticism are absurd. Talking about the rates charged for information retrieval doesn't address effectiveness of the bureaucracy. It does eerily echo the worst of corporate society with its disproportionate emphasis on the bottom line, without regard to its larger effects on the world around it. In the end, the terrorism campaign has been going on for 13 years. Helpman cites that fact, the steady stalemate, as a victory. The persistence of the Ministry is more important than its results. Sam still has to fight the very tool he hopes to use. His new office is adversarial, like his apartment. Harvey Lime is another manifestation of the system, suspicious and incompetent, offering false camaraderie as a defensive measure. There is a hint, a bit of a throwaway mention, that info retrieval has its own hierarchy. At the bottom, where Sam has to start, isn't any more useful than records, where he left. Moving up to Jack's level shows more of what we were perhaps expecting. The open panel in the background of the earliest scenes in Retrieval shows that what looks like more effective technology than we've seen anywhere else in the film up to that point. Is that just a veneer, though, like the robot in the lobby? It is hard to escape a feeling that Retrieval still doesn't produce results, mistaking activity, as frenetic and coordinated as it seems superficially, with actual progress of some kind. Within the Ministry, we are exposed to two kinds of incompetence. Central Services is functionally incompetent, but mostly harmless. The most malicious it gets is with Sam's apartment. It isn't anywhere near the severity of the brutal raids conducted by Information Retrieval, or as sinister as Hoskins and his sidekick may appear. Information Retrieval, by contrast, is ruthlessly efficient and effective, but guided by the flawed, hidebound processes of the rest of the bureaucracy. Ultimately, it is just as broken as the rest of the system. This is reinforced on Sam's first arrival after accepting promotion. The lobby lacks the clutter of records. The receptionist says he couldn't be anyone other than someone who is expected. The scene is ambiguous. It is meant to imply how effective the department is. We have to wonder what would happen if someone BS'd their way through, though. The scene afterwards reveals it isn't all that different, a hint that the efficiency is motion, not necessarily productivity. The toy that keeps showing up almost as a running gag, the executive decision maker, was foreshadowing of this. When those directing info retrieval aren't making their own genuine random mistakes, they invite and use random motion, like the toy, to do so. Elements of retrieval are as bad as records. Lime has to blow dust off of his terminal. The fact he doesn't realize it's off, thinking it's broken, reinforces that it isn't really information that animates info retrieval. These examples of incompetence in its different forms serve as foils to going too far with assigning the film hackish qualities. Few things are tolerated less by hackers than incompetence. It signals the antithesis of the hacker mindset in most cases. Hacking is about engagement, curiosity, exploration. Mistakes get made, but they are instructive, and correction is sought. Incompetence is a persistent lack of such learning and fixing. The gap is often seen as easily crossed, but not done so for lack of motivation. Clearly, Brazil has a lot to offer on reflection, even after years of having enjoyed it and never actually thought to dig into it in this fashion, in terms of examples, different interpretations of hacker characters, motivations, the worlds in which they're embedded. It even, I think, has some interesting antithetical elements that operate and cut against that. Of course, these are just my thoughts on sitting down and trying to bring that same sort of philosophical focus around hacking and hacker culture to one of my very favorite pieces of culture. If you have your own thoughts, either from years of watching this, spurred by my comments, or you've watched it for the first time, as always, I'd be happy to hear them. You can send them to feedback@thecommandline.net, and I'd be glad to share them with everybody else. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening. If you enjoy the program, please do tell a friend. Or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can help out financially with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to post a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/GNUPG-fingerprints. The next show, which should go out in the feed Sunday night as usual, will be a news program. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank Liberated Syndication and Wouta DB for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is made from 100% recycled bits. Permission to recycle those further, except where noted, is granted under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you can do what you like with the content as long as you tell folks where you got it and you share your changes under the same terms.